This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And it is Booktown on KPMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. I've been doing this program almost 10 years now, and I've received books from dozens and dozens of publishers. There's probably about 10 or so that I've interviewed authors from for more than two or three books, and there's about five or six that are really the backbone of this program. The people who have the books I choose most often or I think will interest the Booktown audience the most. And of these, probably the one I get the most books from is the University of California Press. And I'm going to devote this program today to books from the UC Press, partly because they are not the sort of books, at least the ones I'm going to do today, are not the sort of books you necessarily would expect to have come from a university press. Many of them are quite personal. Many of them are on very controversial topics. They're not dry or scholarly. And we're going to look over the whole range. I have three authors I'm going to talk to today, and then, half a dozen other books that I could have featured instead, I'll probably mention along the way. Today I'm going to be talking with Scott Sampson, who is a veteran paleontologist and dinosaur explorer, about his book Dinosaur Odyssey, and then later on with Bryant Simon about his book Everything But the Coffee, which is a study of Starbucks and American culture, and then finally Dr. Paul Lindy, Danger to Self, which is tales from the San Francisco General Hospital Psychiatric Emergency Room. But first, Dinosaur Odyssey. Scott Sampson is a dinosaur paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and educator. He serves as a research curator at the Utah Museum of Natural History and is the adjunct associate professor in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah. And he's written a book called Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads in the Web of Light. Excuse me, in the Web of Life. And this is I will admit to being one of those people who was not enthralled with dinosaurs when I was six. I've been mildly interested in them here or there, but I've never sat down and read an entire book about them. This one is really the first one, and it's quite a revelation. So welcome to Booktown, Scott Sampson.
Thank you very much, Eric, and I'm honored that my book was your first dinosaur book.
I've read lots of picture, I've seen lots of picture books, but nothing that really goes at it systematically.
Right.
And I must say, it's a much more complex field than I imagined. I didn't realize how many sub-varieties there were, and I also didn't realize how many creatures that we tend to think of as dinosaurs really aren't dinosaurs. So how would you define a dinosaur?
Well, there's that, and then there's the fact that creatures that we don't think of as dinosaurs really are dinosaurs.
Yeah, I'm holding off on that for a minute.
Okay, so, yeah, how would we define that? It's one of these things, to define a dinosaur gets you into detailed anatomy pretty quick, and so we don't want to go there, but I will just say that it doesn't have anything to do with body size or brain size or crests or horns or spikes or any of the things that we normally think of when we think of dinosaurs. It has to do with mostly the way they walk, things that involving their hip bones and their limb bones, and the fact that they brought their limbs right underneath their bodies instead of being sprawled like a lizard or a crocodile, they have more upright limbs like mammals. And that was one of the innovations that maybe led to part of the success, at least, of dinosaurs.
And they were the dominant life form or animal life form in the Mesozoic era from about 250 million years ago to about 65.
Well, I would throw in one proviso to that. I'd say they're the dominant big-bodied life form. I think it's hard to argue for dominant life forms anything other than bacteria through the whole history of life. And even if you look beyond bacteria to things like, you know, fungi and insects, in most ecosystems throughout the history of terrestrial life, those kinds of life forms far outdid the vertebrates. But in terms of the charismatic megafauna of the time, certainly dinosaurs were dominant for about 160 million years.
And you say that they have a different leg form than previous reptiles. What happened? Why did they suddenly change from, say, being crocodiles or turtles who do their job pretty well?
Well, and that's also not a simple question to answer. It turns out that other groups of animals did this, perhaps independently and perhaps prior to the evolution of dinosaurs. The crocodiles we see today as these sprawled-legged things living along sides of rivers and lakes are maybe not the standard crocodile form in the early evolution of crocodiles. Some of them were good runners running along on fairly upright limbs. Other closely related groups of animals, like the flying reptiles, the pterosaurs, also had more upright limbs. So this wasn't the sole possession of dinosaurs, even within this group of reptiles. But they did take it to another level, and there are manifestations of it in sort of the way the hip socket is made. Why they did it, those types of questions are really hard to answer for evolution, because what you're trying to get at is what was the original impetus for doing that, and those types of things are hard to nail down for even animals living today, let alone animals that lived millions of years ago.
And roughly, the dinosaurs are broken down into bird-hipped and reptile-hipped dinosaurs.
Yeah, bird-hipped and lizard-hipped. And the one confusion there that often comes up is that the birds did not come from bird-hipped dinosaurs, as one might expect, but they're the descendants of the lizard-hipped dinosaurs that independently changed the hip bones to be more like birds.
And I guess you've let the cat out of the bag that birds are the one existing form of dinosaur.
Yeah. Well, I was going to leave that to you to let the cat out of the bag, but certainly you could say that, I mean, given that they're the direct descendants, some people, including myself, would argue that, in a very real sense, birds are dinosaurs, so they didn't really go extinct 65 million years ago.
And there are other creatures that usually show up in dinosaur books, like ichthyosaurs and a lot of swimming and flying reptiles that are not dinosaurs.
Absolutely correct, and including lots of mammals that tend to show up in these dinosaur books, things like Ice Age mammoths and the big sailback Dimetrodon, which is on the more closely related to you and I than it was to any dinosaur. So yes, if it's extinct and it's a monster, it tends to end up in the dinosaur books, whether that's a good place for it or not.
Now, you say that when dinosaurs started changing their leg arrangement, they became bipedal for the most part, and they were mostly carnivores, but that didn't last. Many of them became four-legged again, and many of them became herbivores.
Yeah,
it's very complicated.
It is. They seem to have started out as little animals walking around their hind legs with their hands held free. But as you said, it looks like a number of lineages of these animals went back on all fours. And particularly if you're going to grow to giant size, it helps when you're balancing your body weight on four limbs instead of two. T-Rex kind of pushed the envelope there on just how big you can get walking around on two legs. But it's been a complicated history to try and unravel.
So why did, if these two-legged dinosaurs like T-Rex were so fierce and so successful and managed to live off of other animals, why did they switch, or some of them switch back to four legs, big bodies, and plant eating?
Well, it's interesting. None of the carnivores did. All of the carnivorous dinosaurs, as far as we know, were bipedal, walking around their hind legs. It's only the plant eaters that did that, the big sauropod, the big, like, long-necked brontosaur-type animals, and the huge horned dinosaurs and the tank-like ankylosaurs and these big dome-headed pachycephalosaurs. There's a number of groups of these things, and among those, some retained walking on their hind legs, like the pachycephalosaurs, but a number of them, like the horned dinosaurs and the big sauropods and et cetera, did go back onto all fours. And the reason for that, it's easier to get big when you're walking around on all fours. That's one thing. And once again, we're at the point where evolutionists tell a lot of just-so stories, and these things are fun, and it's what we're sort of interested in addressing, but they're very difficult ideas to test. When you ask a question, why does an animal switch from walking on two legs to four legs, you're really asking a whole series of questions, because there's what was the might have been an initial trigger, but usually in evolution there's a whole series, a sequence of triggers that make such a transition occur, and so unraveling those and the sequence of those is all part of the fun of evolutionary biology.
Ever since people started reconstructing dinosaurs, or really doing it on a large scale 100, 150 years ago, we've known that they lived in warmer climates and that their life was very different in places where we find dinosaur bones now, like in the arid mountain states or Midwestern states, were lush and warm. But they were also in very different places and had very different relationships to the rest of the world several hundred million years ago.
Yeah, I mean, dinosaurs have been found on every continent, which on the face of it makes you stop and think, well, how did they get there? Did they swim, whatever? And it, of course, they didn't have to do that. They could walk. When the dinosaurs first appeared, all the continents were united as one giant supercontinent called Pangaea. And then for the next 160 million odd years, Pangaea broke apart as if, you know, a giant asteroid had hit the planet and broken the continent apart. That's not how it happened, but it almost looks like a breaking pane of glass if you speed up the separation of the continents over time. And the dinosaurs were literally on board these continental rafts, and they just went along for the ride. And as these continents split apart, the dinosaurs on board took off on their own independent evolutionary trajectories. And every once in a while, these continents would bump into each other like bumper cars, and the animals and plants, including the dinosaurs, would be exchanged. So it is a complex and interesting history, but dinosaurs got a start by spreading all over the globe. And they are found in places like the Arctic and the Antarctic. And this was a hothouse time. There were no polar ice caps that we know of for most of the age of dinosaurs. And in fact, the polar regions were quite lush. Having said that, there were still months of the year that were in complete darkness at the poles. And so the question is, were the dinosaurs there year-round? And if so, how did they manage during those dark months? Or did they migrate in and out of Arctic regions or polar regions? And I think the growing consensus seems to be that at least some of them stayed behind all year round and eked out a living, which is yet another reason that we're really trying to unravel what the role of dinosaurs was like. I mean, a lot of the biomes we see around Earth today, grassland, tundra, rainforest, etc., just didn't exist during the age of dinosaurs, but we don't really know what the biomes were like at that time. So it truly was a different world in some respects.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book, and one of the most interesting things about it is the putting them in an ecological position. And there were flowering plants only developed about halfway through the age of dinosaurs, I would say. And what they ate, the ones who weren't eating each other, was very different from what any animals eat today.
Yeah, I mean, like 90-something percent of all the plants today, about 95% of all plants we see around us today are flowering plants. Angiosperms, and angiosperms only appeared in the Cretaceous, the last period of the dinosaur age, and so prior to that, it was conifers and ferns and cycads and all kinds of other plants that made up the fodder of the plant-eating dinosaurs, and we have places that preserve large components of these vegetative webs, and so we're starting to put those together, but we're still a long way off from sort of reconstructing even the basics of these ecosystems. It's a project which is going to be fun, and a lot of people think that we've pretty much figured out all there is to figure out about the world of dinosaurs and the realities, we're just scratching the surface. We're at a very exciting time. More dinosaurs discovered in the past 25 years than in all prior history. And only now is the science maturing to the point where we can really put all the pieces together with plants and climate and other kinds of animals and really understand what their world was like and how it compared to our own, both similarities and differences.
You say in the book one of the reasons there have been so many discoveries in recent years is because there are so many more people out there looking.
That's true. So many more people out there looking. We're looking in places we've never looked before. The more inaccessible places are being explored. I mean, I've had the opportunity to work in places like Madagascar and Kenya and Zimbabwe, and we're working in places where literally paleontologists haven't spent much time at all ever. But even in the United States, most of my fieldwork now is concentrated in southern Utah, and there's a place there called Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which was the last major region in the lower 48 states to be mapped simply because it was so rugged. People just went around it. And today it represents one of the last major, almost unexplored boneyards. And over the past decade, we've pulled out on the order of a dozen new kinds of dinosaurs from this one vast area. But it just shows us that we're still just scratching the surface.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and today I'm featuring books from the University of California Press because I'm trying to squeeze a number of them in. I can only talk with each author for a short time. We've been talking with Scott D. Sampson about his book, Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads in the Web of Life. And it's a very exciting book. If you knew nothing about dinosaurs, it's actually got much more than I can ingest for some time. I would probably have to read it several times before it completely made sense to me. But those of you who started out when you were six, this is probably the perfect book to bring you up to date. So thanks so much for being with us, Scott.
Thank you, Eric. You take care out there.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And I mentioned that there were so many books that I could have dealt with. Another one I could have done instead of Dinosaur Odyssey is Darwin's Universe by Richard Milner. He's the editor, well, really the author, and it's an A to Z almost dictionary of evolution, another book that's a topic I know much more about than I know about dinosaurs, and I found it equally fascinating. And I'll be back in just a minute with Brian Simon, who will be talking about Starbucks. So back to Booktown. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm sort of rushing because we've got so much to fit in this hour in which I'm featuring books from the University of California Press. I told you I didn't know very much about dinosaurs. I'll have to admit that I know almost nothing about Starbucks because I don't drink coffee, and I've only gone in a few times with other friends or occasionally bought some tea at an airport Starbucks. So for me, Brian Simon's Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks, is quite a revelation. Brian Simon is a professor of history and the director of American Studies at Temple University and has previously written, among other things, a book on the boardwalk at Atlantic City. It's called Atlantic Boardwalk of Dreams, Atlantic City and the Fate of Urban America. Welcome to Booktown, Professor Simon.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
As I said, I know almost nothing about this, and I was a little confused, I think, by all the flavors and all the different ways that Starbucks coffee has changed and all the things it's introduced. They make almost no sense to me, although even I have heard of a Frappuccino. But I'm much more fascinated by the place you think that Starbucks has taken in American culture in the last 20 years or so. How is there a simple way to define this? I think not, because every chapter starts out one way and ends another.
Well, I don't think there is a simple way to define it, and I think that's, if I gave you a simple answer, it probably wouldn't reflect the broad experience of most Americans. People use the brand, and Starbucks has marketed the brand in different ways to appeal to various desires that a huge cross-section of Americans have. And that's what I was trying to get at in the book, how we could read back, in a sense, why we bought Starbucks and how it could tell us about what we cared about and desired the most in America.
Now, it started out as a single coffee house in Seattle and could have stayed that way, but an outsider, a person who had no coffee experience, bought it and then started expanding it, and he did very different things than what the original owners had in mind.
Yeah, the original owners, who would go on to actually own Pete's in Berkeley, it wasn't even a coffee house. It was actually a place to buy whole bean coffee. And in part, they were after two things. One was, it was in some ways a kind of rejection coming out of the 1960s of the mainstream popular culture and the way it blanded us and made us all the same. And secondly, it was a similar kind of impulse to market something natural. So what they sold were beans. And they tried to educate people about coffee. And then Howard Schultz would take over the company. And he wasn't interested, as the original owners were, in a kind of outside the mainstream company. He desperately wanted to thrust the company into the mainstream. And he used this everyday commodity of coffee to do so.
But he did it by appealing to the very upper tier of the mainstream.
Yeah, what he did at first was, a really smart marketing move. He appealed to the upper tier of the mainstream, not the hippest sort of people right there in that upper tier. He got them to be the adapters, and then the emulators followed. And that's the way cultural products work the best. If they can get themselves in the hands of kind of elites, lots of people want to be like, then the emulators will follow. And you can see this in Starbucks' kind of trajectory. At first, the average Starbucks consumer made somewhere in the neighborhood of $80,000 a year. A couple of years ago, that number had dipped to 55,000.
And the number of younger people and the number of minorities had increased.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And the young people is an interesting thing. I'm in my mid-40s, and no one I know really drank coffee when I was a kid. And now lots of people drink coffee. Lots of teens do, and they're a really important part of Starbucks' constituency. And in some ways, the way in which the company is trying to create lifelong consumers.
Although you point out that a lot of the younger people don't drink real coffee, they drink these frothy mixtures.
Yeah, part of what happened that Starbucks grew, it sort of moved further and further away from that early coffee-ness. And so one of the things it sold at first was, again, these natural products, kind of products that suggested that you knew something about coffee, and certainly at Starbucks, that you paid them extra for that knowledge. But as Starbucks moved into the mainstream, it moved further and further away, literally from coffee, and began to sell more and more other things. And that ultimately would hurt the company. It's a sort of, they reached the tipping point where the drinks seemed too inauthentic at a certain point.
But the other thing they were selling was a place to hang out.
Well, they were selling a place to hang out, or that's the way people used it, but they loaded that with more meaning. Starbucks, the people behind the corporation, sensed that Americans were suffering from a kind of social isolation, a feeling of being alone, not particularly happy living in gated communities. And they offered the brand as a way to belong, but also as a way to create community. And again, the founder, the CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, would talk about his company as a third place. And he borrowed this from a sociology professor, Ray Oldenburg. And Oldenburg really meant these places between work and home where strangers who didn't know each other in other ways would come together, get to know each other, and through conversation develop a deeper, richer sense of community. What happens at Starbucks is people come together, but they rarely talk. And so here's a case where Starbucks markets a desire, a deep desire for community in the United States, and basically doesn't fulfill that. Now, it's not entirely Starbucks' fault. I think while we express this desire for community, we're not entirely sure how to go about it, and we're not very trusting of strangers anymore. We've lost the ability to talk kind of spontaneously, and Starbucks lacks the kind of bartenders that you'd see, say, in Cheers, who will be the connectors. The workers move around way too much to play that connector role, usually.
And you say that the corporation is quite aware of this, the way they place their tables. They're trying to make people feel safe, but not communicate too much with one another.
Yeah, I think that I quote in the book this idea again. I mean, back to what Starbucks tells us, desire for community. Starbucks markets us that desire, but they also know that we're a little tentative about it. And so literally they put those round tables in there because they know that round tables are difficult for people who don't know each other to inhabit together, that you can feel alone comfortably at those round tables. They also, the traditional coffee house, the traditional third space, is a place of really free speech. Literally in the coffee houses of Samuel Johnson's era, someone would read the papers and people would then argue about them, and it cost a penny to get in, and people sat on benches together, so not individual round tables. And Starbucks makes gestures towards that as well. I mean, some of your listeners might remember when they put quotes on the cups. Well, they said those were there to incite conversation, but the quotes were either so innocuous that no one could would actually disagree with them, or when there was controversy, they pulled the cups. So it was the appearance of conversation that they were after, the appearance that people wanted to be engaged in a kind of deeper discussion without the actual substance of it.
You even say that many people actually use Starbucks not as a third place, but a second one, as a substitute office where they don't want to be interrupted.
Yeah, I think this speaks again to changes in American life. More and more Americans commute, more and more Americans telecommute, more and more Americans don't have an office anymore, but they need a place to work. And what you see happening is that people will pay the premium for Starbucks coffee in order to rent real estate. And what that creates is almost a study hall effect at Starbucks. With all of these people there working on their laptops, the place is painfully silent. And yet again, I think what we see is the loss of an opportunity in America for the kinds of connections that we say we want.
But one of the other reasons people go to Starbucks is to sort of reward themselves.
Yeah, I write a chapter about what we could call self-gifting or retail therapy. And this was a chapter that kind of surprised me. I didn't start the book thinking I was going to get this information. But again and again, people would say to me, yeah, I go to Starbucks. I go when I'm not in a good mood. Or I go when I have done really well on a test to reward myself. Or I go when I've had a fight with my partner and extra calories will feel good. There's actually even a Sex and the City episode where the Sarah Jessica Parker character goes to Starbucks after having a fight with their boyfriend. And what I see happening here is that as buying and consumption takes over more and more of our lives, how else do we reward ourselves but by buying ourselves something? And here, the elevated price of Starbucks enhances the treat. Even the elevated calories enhance the treat. Psychologists will tell you that when there's something illicit or slightly forbidden about something, that makes the indulgence of that thing more gratifying, even if it elicits some guilt. And so Starbucks has turned itself into this kind of everyday way of buying yourself a treat. And this is good business for Starbucks because generally the treats people buy are the most expensive items in the stores.
And on the one hand, you say that people like Oprah Winfrey in particular almost encourage people to go to Starbucks to give themselves something to feel good. But then they also use Starbucks as something you should use to discipline yourself.
Yeah, it's a kind of interesting twist, and Oprah sort of is at the center of both of these. Oprah Winfrey regularly, says that she likes Starbucks and kind of identifies with Starbucks. And she regularly encourages her listeners, her readers, and her viewers to reward themselves. And, sort of talking about the way women in some ways, and she's talking to women in particular here, about women sort of hold back too much and that they deserve a treat. Yet she also, and this is also used, that people talk about Starbucks as an excess that they need to take out of their budgets. There's whole things called latte budgets. Calculations of what you could save if you give up your everyday latte that will add up in 25 years, as one person did, to $1 million. I'm not sure at these interest rates whether that will work. But I argue that in a sense that the disciplinary discussion, the idea that you need to take Starbucks out of your budget, further enhances the value of the treat. If everyone's sort of suggesting, or lots of people are suggesting, that this is a kind of way that you're wasting money, that almost enhances the treat, right? Because it sort of suggests that you're defying the kind of logic of everyday advice columnists.
Along the way, Starbucks has gotten in the business of essentially marketing other things like music and also a sense of social responsibility.
Yeah.
Those are two topics. I don't know if we have time to talk about both.
Sure. The one thing, I mean, I think it's really important that, again, what I'm trying to get at in the book is the way in which Starbucks reflects some deeper desires and concerns in America. And I think in the wake of 9/11 in particular, there was a concern in this country that perhaps there were people that didn't like us around the world, and perhaps that we could treat people around the world in a better, more humane way. And this gave rise to the fair trade movement and other kinds of movements that are about ethical sourcing of commodities. And Starbucks really sort of weighed into this. They were first pushed into it, demanding that people buy better products, but more fairly sourced products. But then Starbucks began to market this idea as well. And what they continually sort of marketed, there was something interesting. What they said was that you can make a difference by buying something that's ethically sourced, and there being some of them more ethically sourced, some not as ethically sourced, that you would make a difference. And really, they made the conversation about the consumer, not the person at the other end of the commodity chain. And they gave them a way to represent themselves as people who cared about others and people who did something. And I call this in the book Innocence by Association. By buying at Starbucks, who supposedly treated people decently or treated the environment decently, you were innocent. You no longer were part of the problem. And that people, again, were willing to pay, in some cases, extra to get this feeling.
Now, in the past few years, it's more and more people have noticed that Starbucks really is not as environmentally or socially conscious as it pretends to be, and that other coffee shops are really better places to hang out if you want to meet new people. It seems that the coffee house business that they help create is thriving, you say, but their part of it is diminishing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I say. In a sense, I suggest that the brand consumed itself, that it identified and marketed some of these deeper desires in the United States, and then other companies came along and did a better job of it. Other companies came along and sourced and sold what seemed like more authentic coffee, or coffee bought from with a better story of more ethical beans, better treated farmers, and coffee that treated the environment better. And others came along to sort of say, look, we really are part of the community. We're a locally owned store. They sponsored real conversations in those stores about community issues. And what you saw happening was that the mass market that Starbucks produced started to fragment. And so Starbucks, well, it's still here and it's not going anywhere, doesn't sort of hold, one, the central kind of position it once did in American culture, and also it finds itself competing much more for the coffee audience. And probably the crucial thing that happened is that carrying a cup of Starbucks at the height of Starbucks' power, say in 2005, the person carrying it would be seen as others, somebody who looked discerning, sophisticated, knew better products, cared about the environment, cared about the least fortunate, and finally was somebody that could afford to waste money on coffee. This was, in a sense, an affordable and conspicuous form of status making. But now, by 2006, 2007, when I talked to people, they would say they saw someone coming down the street carrying a cup of Starbucks, and that person didn't know anything about coffee. And even worse, that they were a conformist. They were kind of duped by the corporation. So then the buyer would have to wonder, why would I pay extra for this coffee? Why would I pay extra if it wasn't giving me a kind of boost in status? And so now, I think, and I call my book Everything But the Coffee, now I think it increasingly is about the coffee or about the space itself and not these other deeper cultural meanings that Starbucks once wrapped itself around and was then able to kind of market.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Brian Simon, who's professor of history and the director of American Studies at Temple University, about his book, Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you.
This is still Booktown on KVMR FM, and I'm still Eric Tome. I'm trying to fit in as many University of California Press books as I can in this hour. That's actually only three. I could have chosen quite a few more, but these three are all quite eye-opening. As I said in the beginning, I didn't know much about dinosaurs. I didn't know much about Starbucks, and I probably knew even less about psychiatric emergency rooms. And that's the subject of the last book we're going to talk about, which is Danger to Self on the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist by Paul R. Lindy, MD, who we have on the line with us. Welcome to Booktown.
Thanks, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I said, this is something I knew very little about. I'm going to backtrack for a minute and get into the way you've got it arranged. One, you start out with nearly a dozen actual encounters of yours with specific patients over the last 15 years or so at the San Francisco General Hospital, where you were the psychiatrist in the emergency room, or the emergency room psychiatrist. I guess that's really a different thing.
Yes.
They really deal with the in some ways, the most unfortunate people in society, sometimes mentally ill, sometimes addicted to one thing or another, impoverished, prejudiced against, and people who sometimes have no place to go except a psychiatric emergency room. In the middle of the book, though, about a third of the way through, you bring up the one thing that I thought I did know, and that is about sort of the deinstitutionalization of mental health in the United States that happened from the late 60s on.
Mm-hmm.
I always tended to think it was individuals like Ronald Reagan who had essentially closed down the state mental hospitals, but you point out that it's much more complex than that.
Yes, I mean, it seems like there's a confluence of many different people in society. I mean, I think on the one side there are some civil rights advocates or libertarians were certainly involved. And because these laws, many of the civil commitment laws, changed in the 1960s and early 1970s, it was a product of that era. There were people advocating to liberalize the laws. I think at the same time you had political conservatives like Ronald Reagan and some people even more conservative than him who wanted to save money and not spend the money. And it made for, as politics often does, it makes for strange bedfellows between people who are quite liberal and libertarian and those on farther on the conservative spectrum. And unfortunately, I think psychiatrists historically have been their own worst enemy. If you look at the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was a certain arrogance among psychiatrists, and I think we were given too much power in being able to commit people to hospitals. And unfortunately, I think that kind of boomeranged not just on psychiatrists, but also on those who would come to seek help from a psychiatrist, that it, nowadays it's actually pretty difficult to get the kind of help you need. People are generally not locked up for more than a week or two at the very most, and so we kind of have an opposite problem now, is that people who really need the help aren't able to access it. So things have kind of swung pretty far in the other direction.
And from the stories you tell in the book, you really seem to have two functions. One is to give as much aid and comfort as you can to afflicted people, and the other is to decide, should this person be locked up for 3 days or for longer?
Right, yeah. I guess the stance that I try to take is, as a physician who specializes in problems of behavior and thinking, and, trying to really sort out what is ideal for a patient, and there's often a disconnect between, well, ideally, what can I give this patient or help this patient with, and what's really available. So, and it's tough. You have to wear a lot of different hats. I mean, I really try to be compassionate and, be an advocate for patients, but there are times when I also have to, be strict and set limits with people and send them on their way if I feel like they, really don't, need the kind of help that I have available. So, it's hard sometimes to switch back and forth between those two roles of being sort of a gatekeeper and strict, and at the same time being compassionate and, trying to alleviate suffering.
And most of the stories you tell are fairly heart-wrenching, and some of them are failures, and some of them are cases where you don't know if you succeeded, and
yes,
some of them are cases where you never saw the person again.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, you know, it's the beauty and the beast of the job. I mean, the beauty in a way is that I'm able to really put myself wholeheartedly into clinical assessment in the moment, because it is one of the sort of worst days of a certain person's life. I feel like that, you know, I owe that to them. But the flip side is that most of the folks that I see, I don't see in follow-up, and I don't quite know where they end up, and it can be frustrating to not know. Occasionally, you know, we'll get a letter or a phone call from someone who actually thanks us and says, you know, hey, I'm doing better, you know, that probably won't happen again, but thanks. But, you know, more often than not, you know, we don't see or hear from most of the people we see ever again.
The recurring themes in the stories you tell are people being prone to suicide and people with addiction problems of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
And these really exacerbate one another.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that's become really clear to me over the course of writing the book, is that probably at least 2/3 of the patients I see every day have a significant alcohol or drug problem. And, you know, probably at least half, I have to really sort of sort out each of them independently, because, you know, things like alcohol, of course, can cause depression. Things like cocaine or methamphetamines can cause people to be psychotic. And then the withdrawal aspect of those as well. So if you're coming off alcohol, you have a lot of anxiety and withdrawal symptoms. If you're coming off methamphetamine or cocaine, you can look very much like a depression. So you do have to be a bit of a detective to kind of sort out, you know, what are the, you know, alcohol and drugs, what impact are they having versus what, you know, what this person would be like independent of alcohol and drugs. And, you know, it's just such a huge problem, I think, in our society, is how do we deal with people with alcohol problems and addiction problems. And, you know, the state of the art, unfortunately, really isn't. I mean, I think it's one of the gaping black holes of both medicine and psychiatry, is how do we deal with alcoholism and addiction. And I just think we're really only in our infancy in trying to address those problems.
The people who come in sometimes bring themselves in, but sometimes they're brought in by the police.
Yes.
or even in an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one awful case where you think the police dropped somebody off because he was facing a possible court date, and if they could fob him off on you, that would save them a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, and I don't really blame the police for this, because it's, you know, in some ways there's a larger dysfunctional system, but yeah, I mean, I would say pretty much every day there's more than one of folks who probably should have been taken to jail that are brought to us. And, you know, it puts the police in a tough situation if a person, they go respond to a situation and the person says, hey, you know, I'm going to kill myself. You know, the police officer is not a trained mental health professional, and, you know, they're going to err on the side of caution and bring them to the hospital. So, I mean, I understand that they have a tough job, but, you know, some of the folks will do their best to, you know, avoid jail and avoid going to court and come to us instead. And, you know, there's a huge gray area as well. There's a lot of people who really do overlap the criminal justice system and overlap the mental health system. And, you know, so, you know, by the same token, there are people, I think, that the police take to jail that they probably should have brought to us instead. And I think the police have a terribly difficult job in deciding, you know, what to do with some of these folks out there when they're, you know, face-to-face with these guys on the street and these women on the street. So not an easy job.
Now, in addition to working in the ER, you also go to the San Bruno jail sometime, and you're the doctor for liver transplant unit. And
yeah, some of these hats I don't wear anymore. I worked in the county jail, back when I was a resident. This would be late 80s, early 90s. And then I also spent some time working at a private hospital doing consultations. So some of the stories actually come from other settings as well. So part of my history is I've been a bit of a rolling stone in psychiatry and doing lots of different jobs and wearing lots of different hats to keep my interest. So,
but the main place you work is this large room with a counter in the front with,
yeah,
supposedly only 18, but sometimes several dozen people,
yeah,
milling around in it, and then a couple of seclusion rooms where people can actually be physically restrained.
Yeah, yeah. So the physical layout at San Francisco General is the regular medical and surgical emergency room is toward the right as you come in, and we're actually the psychiatric emergency service. We have our own space, and it's actually a pretty nice, good-sized space. But there are times that we get up into sort of mid-20s in terms of number of patients, and, you know, it can be very chaotic and challenging. And we do have the capacity. We actually have four rooms that we often use as, you know, quiet room to sort of have people destimulate and chill out a little bit. But there, you know, from time to time, we do have to take the step of restraining people and medicating them against their will. I mean, we try not to go that route, but from time to time, for safety's sake, we have to go that route. So,
you talked about the arrogance of psychiatrists back in the 50s when medication was just a standard practice.
Right.
But it sounds, from reading the book, you just said you try not to do it, but it seems like some sort of medication gets called for in almost every case in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think that the arrogance, I think, among psychiatrists in the 50s was more in terms of taking away civil rights, not so much in terms of medication, but actually kind of locking people up for extended periods of time. So with respect to medication, you know, unfortunately, most of the people we see are very psychotic or often very agitated, and a lot of the people we see have a history of violence. And so, you know, we really are about us not getting hurt, the patient not getting hurt, and then, you know, the safety of the other patients who are there. So we do end up using medications a lot. You know, we try to use things, you know, the medications today, I mean, this is sort of the irony, is we have more restrictions on medicating people than we did 40 years ago. But the medications we have available today are much more benign than they were 40 years ago. It used to be Thorazine and Haldol, and now the medications we have a lot fewer side effects. I mean, I feel much better now as opposed to 20 years ago in being able to choose medications that have a lot fewer side effects than the old, you know, the old hammers, which is what I call the old medications. So,
still, it's quite clear that you feel more satisfaction in being able to successfully talk with patients rather than medicate them.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we really do try to sit down and have a conversation and, you know, put a human face on things. And, you know, we really do. I mean, it seems, I think sometimes some of us revel in sort of being cowboys or mavericks, but at the end of the day, I think most of the people who work where I work really go out of their way to sit down and talk to people and, you know, put a human face on the system and kind of, you know, destimulate things that way rather than, you know, jumping to, you know, giving a shot or giving a medication. So, and I mean, for my two cents, I mean, the part of the work I like the best is the actual talking to patients. I mean, psychiatrists are really the last specialists in medicine. We actually are paid to talk to patients. You know, we're expected to actually spend time with patients. And for me, that's a good fit. You know, I like being able to do that, and that's my, you know, my job. So, that is a lot of the satisfaction, is trying to gain the trust of people who might be anxious or paranoid, and then, you know, trying to get them on the right path. I mean, that's, to me, the most satisfying part of the job.
And I think it's clear from the book that you do get a certain satisfaction from the stress.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's really interesting. I had this discussion with my colleagues last week, and sort of, I mean, I've been working there for almost 20 years, and I'm still trying to quantify what is it about those of us who work here. And I think part of it is there's a bit of an adrenaline junkie in people who work in that setting. And as my colleague Bob Buckley, who's worked there even longer than I have, said, he says perhaps we're the couch potatoes of adrenaline junkies. But yeah, there is something about in the moment challenge and the stress of it, that is a fair statement, I would say.
We're running out of time, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to cut it off. But I want to thank you for coming on. I've been talking with Paul Iyer-Lindy, MD, who's the clinical professor of psychiatry at the School of Medicine at the University of California in San Francisco and the head of the Psychiatric Emergency Room at San Francisco General Hospital. The book is available from University of California Press, and I've got to get out of here to make way for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party. But thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Lindy.
Thank you, Eric. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.